Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. Which way forward for your property business? The Bank of England base rate has risen four times since December to 1%, and rates are forecasted to reach between 2.5% and 3% during 2023. The lettings market is lively and house prices have remained buoyant, partly because of the shortage of supply. But wider CPI inflation is expected to peak at 10% this year, and some economists are forecasting recession and falls in house prices next year. The private rented sector faces a raft of new regulation, from the ending of no-fault eviction to a national landlord register in England and stringent energy efficiency standards. Joining me to discuss some of the issues that property professionals are grappling with are David Cox, Legal and Compliance Director at Rightmove, and Hertfordshire-based portfolio landlord and campaigner Jamie Fraser. Well, welcome to Inside Property. Let me start with you, Jamie. I wanted to ask how you're feeling about interest rates going up. I found it quite shocking myself because I'm so used to them being, you know, as flat as they have been. 2009 was the last time that they were 1%. And so I've merrily been going on with two-year fixes, thinking that rates aren't going to go up. But of course, for the first time, I've had to start thinking about five-year fixes to protect myself. How is it affecting you, Jamie?
Yes, it's not good, is it? I mean, my current interest payment is now over £2,000 a month more than it was previously, because some of the rates are climbing quite dramatically on my mortgages. So I've got quite a lot of extra cash to worry about. Do you know what? Normally, I would never mind what the interest rate was doing. I wouldn't mind at all, because you're either paying the bank or you're paying the government tax, and I didn't mind if the interest rates went up, it meant less tax, and the other way around. So it's never bothered me historically. The problem we've got now, though, is with Section 24 being in the mix, it means that as those rates climb and climb and climb, the squeeze on landlords and their finances is particularly acute, because we're paying an extra 20 or 25% of that mortgage increase in extra tax as well. So for me, that's the sticking point. That's where it's really going to become a problem. So like you, I have started to fix some of my mortgages. I've fixed them for longer terms. I would normally have done the 2 years, just like you did. But now I'm looking at minimums of three and ideally at five where possible. I don't like five-year fixes particularly, because you never know what this government's going to do next. So I like to have some sort of escape clause. But certainly a three-year fix now is where I'm at with most of mine.
And just looking at predictions, Jamie, we've got Capital Economics predicting that average mortgage rates are, well, they're 1.6% now, and that they'll be about 3.6% in a couple of years' time. And the market in general thinks that rates will go up to about 3% and then probably start to come down after a couple of years. And so I guess if you take out a two-year fix now, it could leave you in sort of quite a sticky situation in 2 years' time. And that's what I've been doing in terms of cash flow forecasting as well, seeing where I'll be. Something like 3 million fixed mortgages will be ending this year and next year. So a lot of people are going to be in that situation, aren't they, where they're going to have a sudden jump?
Yes, they are. And actually, I think that is going to be quite problematic for people. I don't see interest rates coming back down particularly quickly unless we get further and further into recession and the government needs to act. Otherwise, I would agree with everybody else. I think they're going to remain what we would consider to be relatively high compared to the last few years. They're not high at all, of course. They're still very, very cheap historically. But as I say, with the extra complications that the landlords face in their tax and finances, I think each increase upwards can be quite catastrophic for some people.
There'll be people with long memories who will remember over 10% rates in the early 90s. David, what do you make of all of this? What impact could rising interest rates have on the housing market? You're already starting to hear from some economists that prices could fall in 2023.
We certainly are, yes. I would say I agree with everything that you two have just been talking about, and somebody who has personally just put their remortgaged on a five-year mortgage rate. I think we're all looking and coming to the same conclusions. However, what I would say is it is not dampening demand in the housing market at the moment. There may be sort of doom and gloom on the horizon, but at the moment, we're not really seeing it. I just give you some stats on site at the moment. Looking at sales prices to start with, we were at a 9.8% increase in terms of advertised sale price on this time last year. If you look at London, that is a bit less, just 6%. Looking at the rental market, rent across the UK up 12% at the moment, year on year. London up 16%. And in terms of demand, we're seeing a slight drop in demand on for sales properties, but that's reversed when you get into London. So London, we're still seeing an increase in demand based on last year. And in the lettings market, it's still incredibly hot. Demand from tenants for new properties across the country up 20% on this time last year. London up 31%.
How much of that, David, is kind of post-COVID, though? Because, of course, prices fell by 25% in inner London, didn't they, in central London, during the pandemic. So is a lot of this about a bounce back still from COVID?
I think there is an element of bounce back. And London is, you know, London is always slightly different to the rest of the country. But we are seeing such demand, availability of properties, you know, the stock levels are really quite substantially down, more so in the lettings market than the sales market. At the moment, availability for rentals down 40% year on year. In London, 60% less stock, which then has the consequence of the time on the market. And they are literally flying off the shelves at this point in time. For tenants looking in London, time on market is down 52% on this time last year. We saw for the first time ever, even the sales market, time on market was at less than a month for the first time ever over the last few weeks. So, you know, property is still very hot. There is doom and gloom on the horizon, potentially, with not being, certainly it is not being made out based on the traffic stats and the information that is coming onto Rightmove at the moment.
Are you finding this, Jamie, in Hertfordshire, that, you know, rental properties are kind of flying off the, you know, the property portal, so to speak?
Richard, in my experience, currently the rental properties are not even making it onto the portal.
Oh, wow.
They're where I am in Stevenage, and I'm in touch with many other towns, and I invest in Peterborough as well. The agents literally have nothing. Not a single property to rent. And I've just come to the end of a refurbishment on one, and I put it on with an agent yesterday, and they said, we've got like 30 applicants just off our list to start with before we've even advertised it.
Wow. You mentioned refurbishment actually there, Jamie, because there seems to me to be an irony that, you know, rents are going up and we're managing to rent properties quickly. But of course, construction prices have gone up by 60% in some cases, haven't they? And there's a shortage of labour. Are you finding that that's affecting your business?
The materials costs are certainly more expensive. There's no doubt about that. The labour is not really affecting quite so much. I may have to pay a little more for it in places, but I've generally got a good team who work for me quite regularly. They know what I'm doing. They know what I'm looking for. So actually, I'm fairly well protected on that front.
Okay. And David, I mean, we've got this tight supply at the moment. Is there any evidence that this is going to shift going forward?
It's starting to weaken a little bit, but not massively, I would suggest, at this point in time. We are starting to see a slight softening of the market, but as Jamie said, now we are aware that, you know, particularly in the rental markets, properties are just not making it to the portals because they're going so quickly. And when they are on the portals, they are literally there for a matter of days before they're going. I just thought I'd quickly have a look whilst you were talking then about prices and, yeah, what is the effect, what has the effect of the pandemic been, and particularly for London. But looking at the prices in 2019, the sales market is up on average 17% on 2019 at this point in time. In London, that's only 8%. Lettings are up about 20% on the same time in 2019. And again, London is up 12% on the same point in 2019. So they certainly did see it, particularly in London, we did see a hit, but they've come back again, and house prices have reached their, have passed their pre-pandemic levels now.
So, David, what do you make of these figures that we're seeing from some of the economists now? So, for example, Capital Economics say that whilst we'll have house price sales rises of 8% this year, they could fall by 3% in 2023 and 2% in 2024. And also CEBR think that prices could decline by 2.9% in 2023. So is this doom-mongering, or do you think it's you know, could be the way we're going?
I think it is very possible. We are going to have to see how the government responds to some of the challenges that we have got coming down the line. I'm talking about the cost of living rises generally, specifically energy, petrol as well. You know, these are record prices at the moment. People do not have the levels of disposable income. We're also going to need to see what is going to happen to wage prices when we're seeing such significant inflation at the moment across the cost of living. What is that going to do to wage increases come the end of this year, beginning of next year? Because if we're not seeing wages keeping pace with inflation, that means purses are going to be squeezed across the country, which will inevitably have an impact on house prices. We will see, and of course we monitor traffic prices, etc., coming through the site on a regular basis. So we will be able to, we will see if prices start to dip, but at the moment we're really not seeing it. So I can kind of talk in real time predictions. I think we are in such a challenging time with so many factors and so many variables probably being more up in the air than they have been for the last 20 years at this point. We're coming out of a pandemic. We're seeing soaring prices. We've got a war that is impacting food, energy, and everything else at a time when we should be on a road to economic recovery, but we just don't know in these uncertain times. You then couple that with, as we're just about to talk about, all the new legislative changes that are going to hit particularly the private rented sector, but also the sales market as well. How is all of that? I would suggest it's almost impossible to make an accurate prediction at this point in time.
Yes, I mean, I guess it's worth mentioning that the Bank of England think that inflation will come down to 3.5% in 2023 and 1.5% in 2024. So they see it as a fairly temporary factor, and they think that wage inflation will be around 5% during that period. So I guess what they think is there'll be some kind of leveling out where wages will kind of catch up with where inflation has taken us to. But it's all crystal ball gazing, isn't it? One of the worries is that, you know, if rents go up and wages don't, then landlords will get blamed for that rather unfairly, actually, because, you know, we don't control rents. People think we just kind of pick a figure out of the air and charge whatever we want, but we're subject to market rents, you know, market forces like everyone else's.
You absolutely are. And, you know, we do see where people massively overinflate the price of their properties. They don't get interest in them. So, the market sets the rent. Tenants, to a large extent, set the rent prices because it is what they are willing to pay for the properties. And as demand is going up at such a rate, it's why, you know, we're seeing burgeoning demand meeting reducing supply. It is basic market economics that when those two happen, prices go up. Yeah. I don't know why at times people think that the rental market doesn't operate in exactly the same way as every other market. You're seeing the price of food in the supermarkets go up because it's costing the supermarkets more to buy the food because it's costing the farmers more to produce the food. And yet we get politicians of every persuasion regularly failing to understand that basic concept that they're happy to agree to in other industries, but they don't see that the same rules apply to property when, of course, they do.
Jamie, one last question on rent. I had a policy of not increasing any of my rents during the pandemic period. So, you know, over that kind of 2-year period. But, you know, because interest rates are going up, my mortgage costs are going up and my tenants' rents are kind of falling behind market rents quite substantially. So I have started to raise them this year, only very modestly. I felt a bit bad about it because, you know, of all the other pressures I know people are experiencing. But tenants have come back and been quite reasonable about the whole thing. How are you finding that situation? Are you able to increase rents, or is that something that you're not doing at the moment?
I've always had a policy. I've been in this business 25 years now, and I've always had a policy of not raising rents at all, ever, on existing tenants. And I'd stuck to that, and I still, for a small handful of them, I'm still sticking to it. But the problem is, once Section 24 came in, that became impossible. It was absolutely impossible to maintain rents. So each time a tenant changed, I would charge full market value right to the top with no compunction whatsoever. I'd always try to offer them cheaply. I don't do that anymore. So they're full market rents. And for the newer tenants that I've taken on, the rents will be rising in line with what I need for both Section 24 and the rise in mortgage costs.
Okay. Well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, and my guests are David Cox, Legal and Compliance Director at Rightmove, and you've just heard from Hertfordshire-based portfolio landlord and campaigner Jamie Fraser. We're talking about which way forward for your business in uncertain times, as David put it rather nicely. And we're going to move on now to looking at regulation, and in particular, let's start with the Queen's speech and some of the changes that were put forward in that. Now, the most obvious one, of course, was the changes to possession grounds. We've been waiting quite a long time for this white paper, David, and it's due to come through in summer, we think now. The NRLA has come up with quite a lot of ideas on what the possession grounds should change to. How big an impact do you think this is going to have on the landlord community and on the private rented sector?
See, I'm going to be a little bit controversial here, and I'll wait to see whether Jamie agrees with me or not. But let's actually think about this one for a while. Yeah, we've used Section 21 and we have clung to Section 21, and I've advocated and fought very strongly over the last 15 years for the maintenance of Section 21. But actually, it's because that's what we've had. Now, it was a godsend to the landlord community when it was created in 1988. But it's not perfect by any shred of the imagination. Now, by going down a Section 21 route, a landlord is basically saying, right, I'm going to cut my losses. I'm going to ignore the fact that they owe me thousands of pounds in rent. I'm just going to get them out so I can get my property back and get it making money again as quickly as possible. That's not a perfect solution. They've paid for a service that you are literally agreeing by going down a Section 21 to let them walk away without paying for it. So my view is that if they can change it so that it actually works for everybody, we might end up with a better situation going forward. We will lose our no-fault possession, but if they can make those grounds work better than the Section 8 grounds ever did, then it might end up in a better situation. And we look to Scotland, where they haven't had Section 21 now for, four years, I think it is. And yes, it's caused a bit more, a few more challenges at times because they haven't had the no-fault possession, so they have had to, have an actual reason. But I think that probably it makes it a little bit fairer. And once again, the Scottish system, it does seem like it's working a little bit better than what we had before. It's certainly faster, and this is, it depends how they are going to do this. If they're just going to tinker with the grounds of possession, that I would suggest is a massive missed opportunity. But let's embrace the fact that we're in 2022. Let's bring technology into the proceedings. Let's speed things up. If they are mandatory grounds, do we need a hearing at all? We really don't. This can be done online. It's a checkbox, just like Section 21 is today. And let's invest in some technology. Now, I might say this coming from a technology company, but let's bring the tech world into the legal world. We've seen through COVID that we can do it. And let's create forms online where landlords can't make some of the silly mistakes that costs them thousands of pounds. You know, you put in, this is today's date. Okay, well, your 2 months notice ends on this date, for example, so that people can't make the minor errors that get cases thrown out every day. Let's sort out the actual grounds of possession so that tenants can't play the system and give money on the door of the court, which throws out your Section 8 notice. If we can overcome some of these problems, I actually don't think it's going to be quite as terrifying as some landlords and some agents think it actually is. And bear in mind, we've basically lived without Section 21 since the beginning of the pandemic anyway.
Jamie, how are you feeling about this? I mean, the NRLA have proposed various changes to Section 8, which is currently called Section 8 grounds of possession. So student tenancies could not just be for education institutions, they could be for all student landlords, improving antisocial behaviour grounds, improving the mandatory arrears grounds, allowing a landlord and extended family to take possession of the property if they want to move in, taking possession if you're renovating the property or selling it without having to give notice at the start of the tenancy. Those are some of the improvements suggested. Do you think it's going to have a big impact on your business, not being able to have Section 21?
Yeah, well, it's a big subject to discuss, actually, isn't it? I don't entirely disagree with David at all. I've always felt that, firstly, I don't really use Section 21 anyway, very, very rarely. Secondly, if Section 8, and that's a massive if, of course, but if Section 8 is reformed correctly, properly, so that we're not jumping through ridiculous hoops or taking endless time, and all of the correct grounds that you'd expect to be there are there, then clearly it's not going to make any difference. And I'm happy enough on one level to say that I would welcome that change. However, I also am of the mind that there are still grounds where Section 21 is going to be necessary. And if we don't have it, it is going to cause problems. I can see tenants getting upset because when they're demanding a Section 21 and you tell them that you can't give them one, that's going to be something of an issue. I can see local authorities becoming upset when they tell you to evict somebody for some reason. Let's say it's a room size issue or some element of antisocial behaviour, and you have to say, well, I can't because there isn't the mechanism for doing it. And certainly while we've touched on antisocial behaviour, it's all very well for the campaigners to say, oh, there will be antisocial behaviour grounds in the new Section 8, but you can never, ever prove them. If anyone's ever gone to court on an antisocial behaviour ground, you'll know it can take forever. Mm-hmm. When I was a local councillor having to help the council evict an antisocial family, it took something like 2 years because of the degree of evidence that the court required and demanded was almost impossible to amass. So then you get the neighbourhood or other tenants in an HMO or other people around your business saying, well, why haven't you done this? Why can't you do that? Well, you won't be able to. And there will be many situations. You know, let's say a house is being wrecked. The house is being absolutely wrecked by a tenant. They're letting rubbish pile up in there. Is there going to be a Section 8 ground that you can effectively rely on to get rid of a bad tenant like that? I'm not convinced. I don't think the government or the courts have got the competence to do this in a way that makes it workable.
And many people have argued that the courts should be modernised before these changes are brought in. David's mentioned using technology. And then suddenly in the Queen's speech, we see this suggestion that there might be an ombudsman scheme that landlords and tenants can go to rather than going to court. Does that bring you any kind of joy or cheer you up at all, Jamie?
Look, do you know what? I don't mind an ombudsman scheme because I'm not doing anything wrong. And as long as the scheme works properly, it's probably a reasonable idea. We are in the year 2022, as David says, and there's a lot more room for things like reasonable behaviour and technology to be used. But whether or not you have the faith in them being able to deliver on that is a whole other issue. So who's going to run the ombudsman scheme? What's going to be the requirements for being part of it? Is there going to be enormous fees and months of waiting time? Because if all it's doing is replacing one element of the court, then I'm afraid I've got very little faith at all, because the courts have never been any good, even before the pandemic.
Of course, and we're very thin on detail at the moment. The other rabbit pulled out of the hat, David, was this property portal. Do you know anything about that? Because I don't think any of us do, really.
only that which was in the document accompanying the Queen's speech,
yes,
which I'm not going to deny, I did have a wry smile about. But there's actually an element that what they seem to be talking about is they want some central resource where you will be able to find out who is the agent, what redress scheme are they a member of, what client money protection scheme are they a member of, where is the deposit protected, and they want to bring that all together into one place. Now, I've actually been arguing for this for years. So they're calling it a property portal. I don't think you're actually going to be able to advertise properties on it. You're just going to be there to find find who your agent CMP, client money protection provider, is. Now, I'm very much in favour of that. I would perhaps question when there are 3-4 very large property portals, why are they not working with the existing property portals rather than trying to create a new one? And you know, getting that sort of information out into the public consciousness, as we have seen with the likes of Boomin and On the Market, is much more challenging than perhaps the government might actually realise. So when you've got several large companies that already do this day in, day out, and get millions of visitors every day, why are they not working with us? But that is up to the government.
I think it's interesting that the Queen's Speech document mentions that there could be performance information on landlords. And of course, my thoughts there were, how might this be collected and what sort of information? Mm-hmm. It would also be good to see performance information on local authority enforcement, of course, which,
absolutely.
you know, as we know, well, only 16 out of 45 local authorities with a selective licensing scheme record whether complaints are social or private housing, and just 20 out of 308 local authorities across England are responsible for half of all improvement notices. You know, it'd be really good to benchmark some of that data and have some of that on a property portal. I'm sure you'd both agree with that.
I would completely agree with that. And so actually, I think the property portal is probably a good idea. I'm very supportive of the concept.
And any thoughts on the National Landlord Register, which was put forward, of course, in the Levelling Up White Paper, and also this proposed decent home standard that's going to be adjusted to include the private rented sector? What are your thoughts on that, David?
Well, I'm sure, I know you've both heard me criticise on many occasions stats that say, well, 30% of private rented properties don't meet the decent home standard. Well, that's because it's a standard not created for private homes. It's created for the social sector. Pretty much every new build property that comes to the market doesn't meet the decent home standard because it's not big enough. Because part of the decent home standard is a space standard.
But the government is saying that they want it to be revised, and there's going to be consultation on that, isn't there? And indeed, it's begun.
There will. I like the concept, and I would like to actually have something that we can hold the private rented sector to that's not something that doesn't apply to the private rented sector. What worries me is that they are going to create space standards with not changing the building regulations. And if they don't change the building regulations and they set a minimum bedroom size for every private rented property that's bigger than the building regulations, then every new build property is not going to meet the private rented sector's decent home standard, because the builders and the house builders build to the building regulations. So trying to do this in isolation could cause absolute chaos, unless they do it sensibly, because we are going to end up in a situation. I live in the Nine Elms Regeneration area in central London, 25,000 new units being built around the US Embassy. Not a single one of those meets the decent home standard. It's ridiculous.
Jamie, the other regulatory juggernaut coming down the road is MEES, of course, the Minimum Energy Efficiency Standard. The government has said that 67% of rented properties are D or lower, and yet it wants rented properties to be C or higher from 2025 for existing tenancies, for new tenancies, or 2028 for existing tenancies. Research has found that the average cost of refitting could be around £18,000 per property. And the government says that the landlord won't have to pay more than £10,000. But a lot of people are getting rather nervous about this. And, you know, I remember chatting to you a few days ago about five-year fixes. And you said, well, you know, what are you going to be doing about MEES? And of course, it's a consideration, isn't it? Do you want to stay in the business? Do you want to maintain that property, given that potentially you've got all this work to do?
Yeah. Well, for me personally, I'm not at all worried about it, because all of my properties are in really good condition. They get refurbished fairly regularly to a very high standard. I don't mess around with my refurbishments. They're always high end, and they always take on as much of the latest MEES stuff that is required. So generally speaking, my property stock always meets the right standards anyway. But for those landlords who are not in that kind of market or are not buying those types of houses, if they've got Victorian stock, say, for example, or anything else that doesn't meet the standards, then yes, it is going to be a problem. And if you hang out on the landlord forums as much as I do, you'll see this is a constant discussion point amongst people saying, how is it even possible to manage some of these changes? The kinds of houses we've got aren't going to cope with it. Does that mean we have to sell? Will we be forced to evict people to sell because they don't meet an energy standard? I mean, really, I mean, I think the whole idea of the green revolution might be founded on good intentions, but there are some incredibly negative effects for everyday people if they push through with it.
Well, NRLA research shows that 24% of landlords are planning to sell in the next 12 months. That's some or all of their properties, and only 14% are planning to buy. And we've seen the private rented sector start to shrink. Hamptons say that it shrank from 5.3 million households to 5 million between 2017 and 2021. Do you think this is going to be a trend, Jamie? Are we going to see more landlords selling than buying?
Yes, well, it already was a trend, and it was a very predictable trend right back as far as 2015. You know, as soon as Section 24 was announced, we knew that landlords would sell up in large number, and they have. And we know from speaking to so many of them and running so many surveys with them that that is one of the key driving forces as to why they have sold. Then you had the stamp duty surcharge. You've got various licensing rules to abide by. You've now got the MEES standards. This is only going to go one way. Now, the NLA reported not so long ago that the PRS had shrunk from, I think it was 20.7% of the market overall to 18.7%, and in the Southeast, 16%. So we can't sustain, if you want a healthy rental market, you cannot sustain those kind of losses for any length of time. Because already, if you hang out on tenant pages, you'll see people all over the tenant pages saying, why can we not rent houses? Why is there nothing available? And it's because the government wanted landlords out of business. And that's what they've got. We don't have a rental sector anymore.
David, there's a broader policy point here that the government's emphasis on home ownership, which again, they really reiterated in the Levelling Up white paper, is kind of the way forward as far as they see housing in, certainly in England over the next decade. They're talking about 300,000 more properties being required every year. And yet the Capital Economics report for the NRLA said that it was impossible that enough social or private ownership housing was going to be built to meet that target, and that there was going to be a deficit of something like 225,000 that would have to be filled by private rented property. And yet the government seems to be deterring landlords from coming into the market. You know, what is the way forward here? Is the government just kind of misguided with this emphasis on ownership?
I think Jamie is absolutely bang on with everything that he's just said. And we've seen successive anti-landlord policies from successive governments, to be fair. Let's not just tarnish this one. We've seen anti-landlord policies really for the last 20 years. So every flavour of government has been doing this. It has ratcheted up with things like Section 24. And that was a big blow to landlords. The government has always thought that that they want to get rid of the, I remember Brandon Lewis when he was the housing minister, he called them mom and pop landlords. And he wanted to see a reduction in mom and pop landlords and a replacement with institutional landlords, you know, Tesco Towers and Google Gardens. and there is no doubt they have come in. You know, we are seeing an increase in the build to rent, built for renters properties, but at nowhere near the level that is going to be sustainable. We also have to factor in that those properties are vastly, vastly more expensive than your average private rented property. And we're seeing those sort of properties coming to site at around 25% above the local market value for a two-bedroom flat, or the equivalent type of property that's not in Google Gardens. So, you know, it's never going to solve the problem because ordinary people can't afford those properties. There's not enough of them anyway. And so what they've done is encourage landlords away from the market but not found anything to replace them, which goes back to our earlier discussion about reducing supply meets burgeoning demand. What happens? Prices go up.
Jamie, I want to ask you finally if you think now's a good time to buy, because I still get asked that quite a lot by people. You know, that old question, buy, sell, or hold. Where are you at the moment?
Well, I've always been a buy and keep forever sort of person myself. However, I have for the first time in 25 years actually started considering selling. I've had offers on houses that I'm now accepting. So some of my properties are going out the door. I will be selling. And my advice, when you say is now a good time to buy, my advice always used to be there is never a bad time to buy property. It doesn't matter what's happening, buy it now. And if I'm brutally honest, if I really am being honest and truthful about what I think, I might still stick to that advice. I still think long-term property is probably not going to do you any harm. But for a professional landlord or somebody looking to take it seriously, I would wait out probably a bit longer. I think there's too much grief coming down the pipeline. And I think until the dust has settled in another few years, we're not really going to know how the sector is going to survive. Because yes, I think it's a grim future for private rents.
Okay, wow. So quite a gloomy prediction there. I mean, certainly landlords coming into the business now need to be very savvy and really need to research the regulatory framework, don't they?
They do. You can't do this accidentally anymore. You've got to be really on your game and know exactly how you want to proceed for the future.
And I would say, if you're thinking of buying, just have one eye on some of those figures that are suggesting possible falls in house prices in 2023. It's impossible to time the market, but, you know, make an informed decision and do some research, of course. Well, yeah. That's it for this programme. My thanks to my guests, Jamie Fraser and David Cox. You can find all 27 editions of Inside Property and get in touch with us via our website, insideproperty.org.uk. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.